Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers. I'm your host, Severin. This is something like our 300th or something like that radio show. Holy moly. And I'm happy to be joined today by Nikiko Masumoto from the Central Valley of California, second generation peach farmer. Oh, more than one generation. Well, anyway, we'll get right into it. Welcome to the show, Nikiko.
Thanks, Severin. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you and I went to school together at UC Berkeley, and now here we are full circle talking about agriculture again.
I know. How time flies and roots grow. It's awesome.
It's awesome. So let's get a little backstory on your Masumoto farm and the peaches and your family's history there.
Yeah, sure. I'm super blessed and lucky. I am the fourth generation to get to touch and work the same soil. My grandfather, my Jichon, he bought the first 40 acres of our farm in 1948, and this was just a couple years after he was released. He and my family was released from an internment camp or concentration camp in rural Arizona because during World War II, Japanese Americans were held in concentration camps, and so he, as a young man, I feel like was incredibly brave to decide to become a farmer, to invest his life in a place, a single place, with the idea of growing healthy food for people. And that's how our farm got started.
And talk about growing up there, going away, and coming back, and how that all transpired. Because your dad's pretty famous in the Chez Panisse set for his epitaph for a peach. And so you kind of grew up as almost like a fast bread of the slow food movement. But then you went away and did dance and other things I don't remember exactly. Give us that chapter.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think like a lot of rural kids, I grew up never wanting to farm and never wanting to come back to the region that I grew up in. But thankfully, my parents gave me freedom to do whatever I wanted and went to UC Berkeley. And it was actually at UC Berkeley in an environmental studies class that I first began to piece together what being an organic farm meant in a much larger context, in a political context. And as I was studying gender and women's studies at UC Berkeley, it dawned on me that going back home to be a farmer might be one of the more radical things I could do with my life. And so that's what I did. I decided to come home, but not before I realized I needed to grow a little bit more, and I went to graduate school to study performance, and that experience has just made the life on the farm so much richer, being able to draw connections between arts, creation, and the love of the land is just one of the things I just love and I'm so grateful for. So that's kind of where I find myself now.
So let's talk about the Central Valley of California. For those who've never been there, it's almost impossible to imagine what it's like. Can you talk about the infrastructure, the air, the land, what you're surrounded with, what the future prospects are? Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. There's so much there. Yes. So the Central Valley of California is this amazing, immense valley with the Sierra Nevada mountain range on the eastern side. And it has been turned into an amazing place for agriculture via lots of different systems of irrigation. And so we have a really complicated and nuanced web of natural systems, fertile soil, with people's influence over the landscape. And as one of my friends who's an activist pointed out, we now have a moment of realization that, you know, farmers, we are part of the hydraulic system now of the valley because of our interventions into natural watersheds. And I hope, I am so hopeful that there's actually been, I hope, a silver lining to some of the drought in California that we've been facing, which is renewed conversations about what sustainable water practices really look like and how we can shape our future to make this place truly sustainable, truly resilient. So that's kind of a shorthand on the waterfront. That we have lots of challenges and opportunity here. Our valley, because of its topography, also happens to be a pocket where polluted air and air with lots of different particles tends to settle. And so we can think of ourselves as leading stewards of air quality, and I certainly hope that our future continues to be full of really helpful practices to make the air better. I know we've been slowly chipping away at some of the challenges in our air quality through lots of different programs, and so I'm really glad to be in a place of challenge because I think it makes me be a much more astute farmer and really think about my place in a larger structure and system of stewardship.
Well, it's a good thing you were raised eating peaches. You can have such a peachy outlook in a place of such profound challenge in terms of the mega irrigation structures that are underlying that valley and its prospects. Let's talk about what clothes the valley that you're on. What clothes are you wearing there crop-wise in the valley? I know that some of those crops are quite expensive water-wise. And some of them are less expensive, and I don't really know where peaches fall on that spectrum.
Yeah, I'm not sure in terms of the actual calculations where peaches fall either. I know that throughout the drought, we've been really trying to expanding our tool chest of what we might do in worst-case scenarios. So last year, we practiced an experiment on every single variety. We have about 10 varieties of stone fruit. We practiced a deficit irrigation, and so we really cut back on the water that we used in portions of each field to test to see what would happen. And it was an interesting experiment. Some of the trees really did not fare well. Other trees were fine, but the fruit itself was really small. So we are doing our best to try to come up with lots of different ideas of how we might respond to water shortages. And one of the other responses that we have had because we have perennial crops is that we've fallowed land. And we're concentrating on trying to grow the best peaches, nectarines, and grapes for raisins that we can on smaller acreage so that, you know, by using a little bit less water that way, we might be able to get back, to move towards a stasis instead of depleting our water resources. So it's a constant challenge, and especially when you're growing something like stone fruit and vines that, you know, those trees, our oldest orchard is about 50 years old, and it's beautiful and habitat to so many native bees and plants and cover crop, and so thinking about the future and what sustainability looks like and if we might have to transition to growing something else, you know, it's something we're considering, but it's also it's a really emotional decision because I've grown up with these trees and it's something we don't take lightly. But for sure, I don't think I would be in this work if I didn't believe in the resiliency of the land and of farmers, and that I'm committed to the bigger picture more than just my individual vision of what I think our farm is going to look like. So yeah, maybe those peaches do help me have a better outlook on things.
Well, and there you are in the context of this big valley, and you know, a question I have as somebody coming in with the advantage of four generations and the you know, some security in terms of your markets and your systems is almost, you know, how are you able to use that land in that work of preparing for the future? And it sounds like this experimentation that you're doing is a part of service, is a service work towards the future in exploring and investigating what might be relevant across broader acreages. And I wonder maybe a little bit about the conversations that are going around, the tactics that are being explored. You know, crops have changed before, crops have failed before. You know, the French wine industry was struck down by Phytophthora. You know, we've had the Irish potato famine. There's a whole long series of stories to do with rapid and radical shifts in agricultural systems that were very well established and that had to reevaluate a path forward, and often, you know, shift quickly. And I just wonder what the kind of word on the street is in the almond community and some of these other perennial communities, how they're thinking about change, and how you, as a young bud, but a young bud with four generations behind you, are going to navigate that space.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I definitely find a lot of inspiration from folks in the sustainable agriculture community. I just got to spend some time a couple weeks ago on an organic walnut orchard up near Sacramento in Winters, California. And it was amazing to see the innovative strategies that they're using to try to conserve water, to try to recharge groundwater basins. And I mean, it was amazing to see 1,500 sheep grazing in a field of organic walnuts, cutting the cover crop down. It was just incredible. So I do think that there's a lot of, that we are definitely not alone in our quest and in our willingness and openness to experiment with methods that really place resiliency and the land ahead of profit and things like that. Now, that said, I do feel a privilege of being able to step into a lineage of farming, and I feel like part of the privilege of that is to embrace these experiments and to share, because I do have the latitude of not having to start from scratch. And so I definitely see a continuum of experimentation and learning that can be shared across the farming spectrum of new farmers, beginning farmers, myself included, across generations, across boundaries of folks who didn't grow up farming the land, but who are dedicated and committed and working now. I'm very optimistic that spaces, especially in sustainable ag communities, really have kept that kind of open spirit that I think is the key to adapting to the future, preparing for the future, and making sure that there's a place for as many people as possible in our food future.
Well, I like the spirit part, and obviously the more manure of sheep there is on the surface of the land, the more spirit there is in the land itself, in terms of the diverse microflora and fauna, the creatures of the land, who, as we all know from our training in organic agriculture, are drought-proofers, and that soil biology is a critical ingredient for resilience. But one thing we have to remember in our spirit talk and in our biology talk is that so much of the context for farm economies on a family scale, on a business scale, on a regional scale, is shaped by agricultural policy. Mm-hmm. And in transition, especially, it feels like getting getting into a framework of possibility within the policy realm is challenging. So currently, the major relationship that farmers have with this crisis is framed by crop insurance, and crop failures and crop challenges and crop transitions are guided by this established program of crop insurance, and it's changed towards it's a migrating framework. And I guess one of the questions is, you know, so crop insurance currently, we know in the last 10 years, paid out in the United States $60 billion to the top 10% of producers. And those are payments that were made, but basically mostly for either flood or drought. Too much water, too little water. But those payments were not made in an effort to transition the kind of production system, or better said, those were not payments made to pay for experimentation or payments made to pay for investigation or new methodologies. Those were just to recover money lost and crop lost. And it seems like, you know, in extension, in the research of our land grants, and within the USDA's new cover climate change program, these new six climate hubs, there's some room for investigating how to set a bounty or put a purse towards the work of transition. Now, I know this is all new and we're talking about stuff that you probably haven't, you know, written papers about, but I wonder if you could just reflect in your region, where would that kind of money get spent? Or what is the research that you see people undertaking just on a volunteer basis on their own farm that could be the kind of work supported by more transition-oriented funding?
Sure. Well, I definitely have seen lots of experimentation in the organic and sustainable ag community, especially at small scale. I actually think this is an opportunity where small-scale agriculture might be the perfect partner because, you know, on our farm, when we do an experiment at a small scale, the risk of, you know, doing deficit irrigation, we can control how much we're willing to risk, and we can really pay really close attention to the results of that. So I think there might be a real great opportunity for lots of different small growers in lots of different climatic environments to try new methods, whether they're with water or soil health or integrating animals into production practices. I would hope that the wisdom of lots of many, many, many different experiments and lots of a community of learning could help to get us closer to a wider array of tools that people could use at lots of different scales to transition farming from the state it is now on a macroscopic scale to something that is more resilient, much more responsive to changes in climate, to the needs of the soil and the air and water above the profit margins. So I think maybe there's a partnership there between small growers to be had.
So essentially, small is beautiful, but small is also tactical in terms of the experimentation needed to readapt our larger scale landscapes for the future.
I absolutely think so.
I think allies for like so much time is wasted in the discourse of pitting growers against one another, and in fact, in this case, in this framing, you know, the small farmer is a huge ally of the large farmer, and that's something we've seen in the organic movement that, you know, often idealists and hippies have gone and invented a marketplace that now a very lucrative marketplace for larger producers to enter and kind of like invented the whole organic sector. And but the work and the discourse and the consciousness and the kind of venues for exchange seems to be not yet very developed when it comes to this kind of resilience project. And I guess the next kind of question is, like, where are these conversations going to happen? How is this data going to be shared? And what are the means by which we, between these communities, share these experiments? I think, do you guys have a Grange?
I'm not aware of one in our area. I do think that there are social networks that are enabled through our digital world that are enabling some of this information to travel. But yeah, I agree with you. I think there's some room for growth in terms of how we might organize ourselves to share some of these strategies of resilience.
Yeah, let's explore that.
Definitely.
So what else do you want to talk about?
Oh gosh, well, I want to know about what you're hearing and some of your perspectives. What gives you hope about food and farming these days?
Well, I just listened to a great talk on Saturday by Vandana Shiva, and she was talking in Southern California, where there's a proposed campaign to spray imidacloprid and pyrethroids across the whole valley against a new invasive bug called the Asian citricillid. And she was challenging the community to rise up and reject the spray and the poison and the destruction of, you know, multiple trophy of insect life and, of course, the birds that rely on them and the whole fauna of the earth. But she said also, learn from the bug. She said, learn from the pest. Use this as an opportunity to discover and reacquaint ourselves with the process of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, evolution and domestication are closely related phenomena, and the difference, of course, being that an evolution in the wild is more self-willed, and an evolution in the domestic sphere has kind of multiple vectors of will being exerted on it, the will of the farmer and the appetite of the eater, the particular circumstance of the place, and then what's latent or living in the will of the plant itself. Mm-hmm. And so it's more of a truce, multi-vectored truce there in the domestic landscape. But still, the will force of the grower and the eater and the plant itself have to negotiate openly. And it feels like for a lot of agriculture in this country, that truce hasn't been renegotiated for a while. Mm-hmm. That the needs and the will of industry in terms of storability, in terms of high levels of production under optimum circumstances, in terms of uniformity, those have been the predominant goals or will, that's been the will force on the human side. And but when she says learn from the pest, I think what she's kind of saying is learn from the adversity. Learn from the other vector of will, which is the circumstance, the ecological context that crop must contend with. And, of course, you could add to that circumstance, the circumstance of less water, the circumstance
mm-hmm.
of, you know, an unending sequence of pests, the circumstance of degraded soil, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel like that's the place of interest to me now, is to figure out the language of that and the stance. So, like, let's get back into intimacy with evolution. Let's get back into intimacy with the direction that we're taking our crop species. The workshop we had on Sunday was a grafting workshop and a top working workshop, and we were reacquainting ourselves with the other crops that were contenders for the landscape back in the 1880s and 90s, and some of the crops that were grown by the Mission Padres and the crops that were part of other analog regions as, you know, alternatives to citrus, as, you know, attendants to citrus, as potential contenders for that space on the landscape. And going into the logic of those early nurserymen, and they were mostly men, they weren't women really, but the guys who were importing fruits from around the world to see what was going to be viable commercially in this landscape. And even just in that process, getting reacquainted with the way of thinking, and the way of interacting with the plant and what the plants were, you know, what the plants can do and what they express and what they know and what they're, so that's exciting to get back into that way of thinking.
Oh, absolutely. It sounds so powerful, the idea of dislodging the singular from a stance of dominance, right? Like whether it's dislodging a human-centric view of the world, right? But where all of these natural resources are here just solely for our purpose. I think that dislodging is a really powerful one, right? That's what I understand you, Severin, echoing. It's so incredible. It's humbling to move, make that move. And I really hear that move also drawing parallels along lots of different types of dominant centers that are ripe for dislodging, right? Whether it's our male-centered notion of what it means to be a farmer in the United States, right? Whether it's our white-centric notion of what it means to be property owner farmer in the United States. And that, I think that work is so integral, and it's hard. I think it's really hard, and I think it requires a lot of compassion and a lot of courage at the same time. Thanks for sharing. That's really awesome.
Well, yeah. Well, and you know, this is a thing we've been saying lately, I've been noticing, I think partially because of the political discourse, is, you know, who is, what we are we talking about in the we's that we are talking, and the we of the New York Times, or the we of Donald Trump, or the we of white man 1%, or the we of educated people, or the we of urban people, or the, you know, if you start parsing into the we of all sorts of we statements that get flung around, it's very soon very obvious that it's not a very inclusive we. And it's
right,
certainly not
right.
a we it's not a relevant we. It's not a we that's relevant to the reality that
right,
we will,
and it's
the
so,
total we will face.
And it seems so easy to think of a singular notion of we when you're in a homogenous environment, right? I dream of and try to practice all kinds of conversations across so many different lines of difference, and I definitely think that's one thing we are sorely lacking in our political system right now, having a diversity of voices at the table, speaking actually and listening to each other. That would be a radical notion in my book.
Again, what's the vessel? What's the vessel for that? And is there a vessel for that in American agriculture? You know, that's been one of the powerful trends in American agriculture. I just learned last week, the statistic that in 1910, 13% of U.S. farms were black-owned, and today it's less than 1% of farms under African-American lineage ownership. Mm-hmm. And the contraction of ownership, of minority ownership, has been one of the powerful trends. I know in the last census that Latino farm operators increased, as did women farm operators. But in looking forward at the trends that we face and the patterns that are prevalent now, if we think about the fact that 70% of American agricultural land or U.S. agricultural land is owned by people over the age of 65, mm-hmm. it does seem a pretty relevant time to look at trends and try and extrapolate forward into the near future and say, well, you know, who will own this land? You know, and will it be a person or will it be an LLC?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, are those spaces even more exclusive and, you know, a constrained we, an urban we, a corporate we, an investor we? So again, I guess just trying to find the vessel where this discourse can happen and say, well, then where would we put ourselves to have this discourse in the context of transition, agricultural transition? I don't have an answer, but that's definitely the question that I want to ask is where to put oneself when there's so much work to be done and so much planning and experimentation and there's so many more people to involve in a landscape that's becoming desertified of people.
Yeah, I definitely think you're speaking to the formidable challenge of how we change the structures of our policies and our world, right?
Let me charge you, Ms. Peach, to turn this around. We have like 1 minute left.
Mm-hmm.
Where can you point us towards some peachy places? People who are interested to learn about peaches and peaching.
Yes, I'm really excited. Just this week begins a rollout of a documentary film that was produced about our family farm. We're incredibly humbled. In this documentary, you'll get to see a lot of what we do, lots of peach juice, and it's going to be played on local PBS stations across the country throughout the month of May. So that's one source. There's some fantastic books about peaches, whether there's an academic text that's amazing out of Washington. And my dad, David Masumoto, has written of a lot of the soul of the peach farmer, too, to anybody who needs some nourishment there. And my dad and I just are publishing a book together that's coming out next month called Changing Season, which takes up a lot of questions of generational transition on our family farm and both the pleasures, delights, and also the challenges of that work.
Wow, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing your peachy story with us, and I hope that anybody who's so inspired will go out there and look for yourself and get messy. Get your face messy with it.
Yes, juices dripping down your chin. That's what we want. Thanks so much for having me, Severin.
Thank you, Nikki. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. The one and only Dave Arnold brings the noise to Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday on Cooking Issues.
Coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn!
If the bomb was going to drop, and you only had 15 minutes, which is like, I can make a sandwich in 15 minutes. He would be eating a sandwich.
I'd kiss my wife, make a sandwich.
If you believe that it's all about to be over, why eat healthy? Not a freaking Neanderthal. I like a tempered ice cream sandwich.
But it's the only way to get around it if you're a party master, because you're going to wind up, like, your kitchen's going to fill with dishes. And
some people have commercial dishwashers in their house.
Who?
I've seen them.
Who?
I've seen them.
Who?
Really rich people.
For more mile-a-minute knowledge from Dave and the crew, listen to Cooking Issues, available on Heritage Radio Network, iTunes, and Stitcher.